It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a few minutes, after House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's primary defeat at the hands of an opponent with Tea Party support, we'll look back at the history of populism in the United States with our resident Central Time historian. First, we continue our WPR News series looking at Governor Scott Walker's campaign promises and how they've panned out.
When Scott Walker ran for governor in 2010, he had a message for voters about the size of the government he wanted to run. Smaller, Walker said, was better. Walker felt so strongly about smaller government that he included it as part of his oft-repeated brown bag promise on the campaign trail. In our continuing series on Walker's promises by the numbers, Sean Johnson reports on whether the governor lived up to his goal.
To fully appreciate Walker's smaller government is better government pledge, you have to remember when he made it. In 2010, many voters were frustrated with government. Republican voters were mad at government. Conservatives attacked government at Tea Party rallies like one in Madison, where a guy dressed up as Thomas Jefferson and told the crowd that they were slaves.
This government is claiming to be all-powerful, and you are its slaves. Are you ready to give up liberty like this?
No!
Even Walker, who's normally reserved, was piling on in speeches like this one at the Republican Party state convention.
We're going to take all those big government liberals and load them up on a train and run them right out of town.
The smaller government pledge clearly worked for Walker in 2010. The question 4 years later is, did government get smaller? Responses were all over the place at a recent Dane County farmers market. Ernie Pearson of Baraboo says he likes the idea of smaller government, and broadly speaking, he thinks the governor achieved it.
I've worked in the private sector my whole life, and to be competitive, you have to run fairly lean, and I think that our government needs to operate in the same way.
Jeff Bybee of Middleton is unimpressed. He says the term smaller government is completely relative.
That's not measurable. And so, again, you're back to a rhetorical argument that's just basically trying to evoke an emotional response. Yes, we need smaller government. Everybody can relate to that, whatever the heck that means.
Indeed, people who research the budget for a living say the same thing.
Yeah, frankly, I don't know how you measure it. That's a totally subjective statement.
John Peacock is the director of the Budget Project at the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. He says one way you can measure government is to look at the budgets the governor has introduced and compare them to overall personal income in Wisconsin.
And by that measure, we are spending a little bit less than we were a few years ago.
Todd Berry with the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance says it's not really the state that's gotten smaller.
It's probably fair to say that local government has been more on hold in terms of size than state government.
Take school districts. Revenue limits signed by Walker forced schools to reduce property taxes a couple years ago, and they allowed a modest increase this year. Ken Bates, the superintendent for the Green Lake School District, says his school has felt it.
We've reduced administrative staff, we've reduced clerical staff, we've reduced custodial staff. We're getting smaller, but how small do you get before you don't exist?
But there are a lot of factors that go into budgets like Green Lake's, some of which have little to do with who's governor. And this is why measuring Walker's small government promise is so tough. But if you boil down state government to factors Walker can control, and you don't adjust for inflation, you see a government that's growing. The number of general fund state employee positions has inched up under Walker, and the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau says actual spending in the general fund is projected to be almost 10% higher at the end of this fiscal year than it was in Jim Doyle's last budget. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We'll continue that series tomorrow with a look at the governor's campaign statements on job creation. The story that dominated political news last week was the surprise defeat of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor in a primary. His successor in that leadership role, Kevin McCarthy, was selected earlier today. Parts of the Tea Party movement around the country supported his successful primary challenger, David Brat.
The Tea Party is one of the latest versions of a long history of populist political movements in the U.S., and our resident Central Time historian is back with us to take a look into that history behind today's news.
Jonathan Pollack is in the studio with us. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He joins us each month to put the latest news in historical context. John, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Rob. Nice to be back.
Well, before we talk about the past and present, let's get a definition in here. What do we mean when we talk about populism in American politics?
Well, that's a great question to start off with. Populism is one of those terms that's kind of malleable, but in general, it's a movement of people against elites. It's kind of an anti-elitist movement. And then from there, if you say, okay, so what kind of elites and what are the aspects of the movement, that's kind of changed over time. Mm. In general, if we want to have a big conversation, though, it's kind of the little guy versus the big guy. And then you can expand that to looking at business. You can expand it to looking at the role of the state governments or local governments versus the federal government. Economics, there are all kinds of ways that populism comes in. But generally, it's like it's the same root. It's like the people. It's like the people are rising up. And it's a cool term because it transcends traditional political labels that different historians will argue that populism is, it's a left-wing movement, it's a right-wing movement, and it kind of has elements of both in it through most of its history.
Well, before we dig back into the history, let's look at how it looks today. And you mentioned it kind of straddles both sides of the political fence. How does that play out now?
Okay, so for instance, in the Dave Bratt, Eric Cantor contest that you talked about at the beginning of this segment, so in that case, Bratt was called, some people called him a populist, mm-hmm. because he criticized Cantor for being out of touch with his district, that he was too concerned with making a name for himself, too concerned with sort of playing with the fat cats in Washington and so forth, and not attentive to the needs of his constituents back in Virginia. And at the same time, on the other end of the political spectrum, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is often categorized as a populist because she's a bankruptcy attorney by training. And so she's been really active in trying to change federal policy on student loans. She's kept a sharp eye on the mortgage industry and so forth. And so she also has been described as a more populist Democratic politician than, say, Hillary Clinton.
Is part of populism, though, not just somebody making the case for the people, but trying to help generate a political movement by the people?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's it's kind of one of the contradictions of populism, I guess, that it kind of presents itself as this leaderless movement of just independently a bunch of people are upset about conditions in their area and they want to do something about it. But also over time, populist leaders have kind of, many populist leaders have been sort of like charismatic leaders who wind up wielding a great deal of power. And in many ways, many populist leaders throughout history, once you get past the rhetoric and you look at where they actually came from and what they actually did and how they affected the scope of party politics in their era, it comes out as, well, the people's interests beyond rhetoric weren't exactly met, and kind of the same people who were in charge before this populist movement remained so afterwards.
Well, let's start digging into the history. Where do you want to start in American history with a big populist movement that made a difference in the political scene?
Well, I think one of the first movements, and I don't believe this was really called populist at the time, it was a term kind of ascribed by historians looking back at it, was really Andrew Jackson's presidency in the run-up to the 1828 elections, that Jackson presented himself very much as a man of the people. Jackson opened up his inaugural party to just the public. And
they kind of trashed the place.
They completely trashed the place. Yeah, they got loaded on something called orange punch. I mean, we're not sure what's in it. And so he had that image, that he was this hard drinking frontier guy, mm-hmm. who brought people like him into Washington. And in fact, what Jackson kind of did, a big part of his platform was really uniting white settlers against Native Americans. That I'd say was one of his big contributions to American politics in that era. But at the same time, in real life, Jackson was a slave owner. He owned hundreds of slaves. He had this huge plantation in Tennessee. And so in that sense, was not from the same background as the people he purported to be part of. So Jackson, I think, is kind of this early populist figure.
And he's kind of reacting to, I mean, the nation was not founded necessarily on populist lines. There was an idea that there should be a lot of advantage to the elite in a lot of the ways the federal government was set up. And Jackson was kind of a reaction to that in part, right?
Yeah, Jackson was a reaction to that, and he was also a reaction to urban interests. And I think this is also another component that frequently pops up in populism, that populism often presents itself as a movement of people from rural areas and small towns who were lining up against people coming out of the cities. In that sense, in a you could even argue the roots of populism go as far back as Thomas Jefferson, who kind of idealized the small farmer and so forth. But that's another component of populism. And Jackson was a Westerner, and presidents before him had come from Massachusetts, had come from more urban areas of Virginia at that time. So in that sense, that kind of adds to his name as a populist.
And so two running themes, you say, often rural-based, hostile to elites and cities, and then race. You started to touch on that with Andrew Jackson. Do you see that as a common recurring theme in populism?
It is something that pops up all the time. I'm not going to say that it always has to be there, but as with the other two, it's one of those things that comes up quite a bit. So, for example, if we go, I already mentioned about Jackson and his Native American policy. If you move forward a couple of generations to the 1880s and 1890s, the populist movement of that era was initially kind of across racial boundaries. There were black populists, there were white populists. However, in southern states, white populists found they couldn't win elections if they didn't pander to racism. So Tom Watson, for example, who came out of the South, was this leading Southern populist out of Georgia, and he turned very quickly, and he became extremely racist, virulently racist. And so in that sense, populists of Watson's generation, instead of kind of scapegoating Native Americans and trying to channel white anger toward them, channeled the same anger toward blacks toward the end of the post-Reconstruction era leading up to the 20th century.
We're looking at the history of populism in the United States with our resident Central Time historian, Jonathan Pollack. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College.
And you can join in the conversation, too. How do you see populism? Is it a positive force in American politics and history, or do you see it as more of a downside? And what do you think about the populism of American history? How does it relate to populism we might be seeing today? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, talk@WPR.org. We continue our conversation about populism in American history with Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Your thoughts, questions, observations about this idea of populism through American history. 800-642-1234. We'll pick up with William Jennings Bryan in just a minute, John, but let's bring on Matt in La Crosse. Matt, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I listened to a radio program that actually had a caller from Virginia talk about Eric Cantor's losing his primary to the David Brandt guy. And the thing is, that what you brought up, Jonathan, was the fact that he did lose based on the fact that Eric Cantor did lose based on the constituency, didn't show up at town hall meetings, sent staff members, and said that as a representative of the people, you actually have to show up and meet with the people, and that's exactly why he lost. And then I'm a little concerned about where you're going with the populism on the racial topic, because a lot of times I hear Tea Party are racist and all this other stuff, and it's like furthest thing from the truth, and I'm just hoping that conversation doesn't go there. I'm a conservative, and I'm the least thing from a racist whatsoever, so I'm really hoping that that's not going to get brought up in discussion. I did hear something like Eric Cantor is like Jewish or something like that, and that was the reason for him losing, and I just wanted to make sure that conversation does not go there, because
Matt, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling, Matt. I want to bring John in on that, on the two points you brought up.
Yeah, so kind of going in reverse order. When I talked about race and the populists, I mentioned, and this was in line with the other issues that populists take position on. The race is something that comes up often, but is not necessarily always there. And it's something that populists will change their mind on. I mean, before he was a racist, Tom Watson was a populist. He folded that in later on. You know, we can look at other if we get into the 20th century and we talk about populism in more detail, there are other areas where there are populist movements where the race issue doesn't really come up. Having said that, though, I mean, I couldn't as one of my big research areas is the American Jewish experience. I couldn't help but notice that one of the similarities between like populists of the late 19th century, one of the things they talked about was they were quite anti-Semitic. When they talked about the cities, they identified Jews with the cities and so forth, and quite a bit of the stuff they put out was out there. And so I've seen there are a couple of things that are speculating about Cantor. I'm not sure that's the case there. I mean, he had deep Virginia roots. His parents were political activists in the Richmond area where he grew up and went on to represent. But there is that sort of, you know, line that could conceivably be crossed if people keep coming up with this, if Cantor, you know, in some ways reasserts himself in regional politics in that part of Virginia, of an identification between Jews and urban areas and so forth. And in a scheme of things where urban areas are evil and the rural areas are good, by that transitive property, therefore, Jews are part of that evil. At the same time, yeah, the caller is exactly right. There are, you know, in the couple of weeks, week and a half, since that election, lots of factors have come up. It's also interesting that constituent service is a big part of it. I mean, just, you know, answering constituents' phone calls, treating with respect, as the caller pointed out, coming to things, that also seems to have a big part of it. I mean, I think the populist angle, though, that's a big part of Bratt's campaign, and it's the kind of thing that politicians in other parts of the country seem to be seizing on and kind of writing about how politicians should be aware of this, that they should continue to run against Washington and against bigness and so forth. And so, therefore, there is sort of a populist tie-in beyond just sort of keeping track of your constituents.
Well, I want to hit a couple more big populist points in American history. I mentioned William Jennings Bryan. I think of him as the big populist, but I don't know as much as I should about him beyond that.
Yeah. So, okay. So Bryan's a great example. So Bryan was not known for his pronouncements on race. And off the top of my head here, not having done extensive William Jennings Bryan's research, I'm not sure what it was. Bryan was an example actually of sort of in the vein of Andrew Jackson before him, of somebody who started out as this kind of man of the people and really built like this movement around him, became this very charismatic leader. Bryan's big issue was really economics. He was for free silver, which would allow... Let me see if I can get the economics straight. It would allow it would be an inflationary policy which would help people who were in debt, because farmers the 1890s had to take on huge amounts of debt to buy seed, to buy equipment, and so forth in advance of the growing season, and then try to repay their debts when the season was done. And of course, if you don't have a good growing season, then you're racking up debt. So that's the constituency that Bryan was talking about. And perhaps I think Bryan's example also brings in another kind of recurring theme in populism that's not entirely consistent, because it wasn't a big deal for Andrew Jackson, for instance, but it is arguably a big deal for populists in the present: anti-debt. That one of the organizing issues of populism, and again, it's not perfectly consistent because populism is a really squishy word. That debt is often a part of it. That politicians running on, opposing debt and fighting debt and so forth. If you're in favor of that, you might be a populist.
Was that a theme picked up in the Depression era?
Debt was not as much a theme there. I mean, the populists I'm thinking of there, in some ways, it wasn't related to debt exactly. I mean, some of the prominent populists in the Depression era were more concerned with the disparities between wealth and poverty. When you look at like Huey Long, the governor and eventually senator from Louisiana, he created the Share the Wealth movement that was a huge taxation on wealth in Louisiana and a big expansion of public works and hospitals and things in that line. You've got Francis Townsend, who proposed an old age pension plan before Social Security. So you've got populists there who are organizing on a bunch of different issues. Beyond debt, neither of them, Long's racial record is really conflicted. People will say, yeah, Long was racist. And people say, no, he actually was anti-racist. And Townsend, to the best of my knowledge, had very few black supporters. So race was kind of tangential again. So populism again. They were still talking about the little guy. There was widespread concern in the 1930s about older people who had outspent they'd lost their savings in the stock market mm-hmm. crash. They had done everything right, and now they were destitute, and that was a problem. Which again it's a separate problem from debt. Really, they weren't destitute because they had bought themselves things they couldn't afford. They had played by the rules, and still they lost their assets.
Before we're done, just one general question. Do economic crises tend to be a boost for populist ideas, populist thinking?
Yeah, I'd say that's one of the things that's really consistent, that that it's an economic movement, that it's an economic crisis that spurs populism. I mean, if you look at times in prosperity in the United States, so let's say the 1950s, there's not really a populist movement. You know, we could probably, if we looked real hard, we could find movements that had some kind of populist tone to them, kind of on the fringes of American politics. You could say the Communist Party of the United States arguably had this populist strand to it, and the John Birch Society arguably had a populist strand to it. But those are tiny. Those are organizations where there's like more FBI agents in there than paid up members. So in prosperous periods, no, populism sort of shrinks away. When the economy falters or when it doesn't recover, that's what brings them out.
John, thanks so much. Could talk for a lot more about this. Thanks for coming up again.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He joins us each month as our resident historian to just give us the historical background behind what's in the news today.